news, conversation, and events. Listen at KAXC.org or on your smart speaker. Keep people-powered radio going into the future with your support now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you for your support. It's 6 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Lisa Bryn Rundle. Coming up on As It Happens.
It's complicated. An Iranian-American soccer fan tells us why he will be at a protest against Iran's national team today, but also in the stadium as that team plays its first FIFA World Cup game on U.S. soil.
Norm decor. Garden gnomes and pink flamingos are all well and good, but this year, the once popular porch goose is making a comeback. And a retailer selling the newly favored ornaments tells us she can't believe the way customers are flocking.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Monday edition of As It Happens.
It is a minute after 6 o'clock. Coming up, we have our album of the week here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks so much for tuning in. Thanks for being a part of this community of people who spend their time, maybe live, maybe visit northern Minnesota, or maybe you're from somewhere else, but you appreciate this sort of authentic radio that makes you feel connected to real people and things happening in our communities. We really appreciate it. You can stay in touch with us by signing up for the Buzz newsletter, or you can text us 218-326-1234. We'd like to thank Rapids Brewing Company for their support. They're a place for gathering and community, featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More info about events, music, and menu, rapidsbrewingco.com. And we receive support from ICTV, streaming news and information for and about Itasca County at watchictv.org. Each week, our music team, that is Kari Headland, Malachi Coons, and DJ Dang, come up with an album of the week. It helps us feel a little more connected to great new music that's out there. This week, they've chosen Isle of Hope by Dwayne Betts. Heartache, There's Nothing You Can Do. That's the opening song on this new album. And the whole album is steeped in grief. It's intense and immense. The album itself is made up of songs he wrote after losing his dad, Dickie Betts, founder of the Allman Brothers Band. We'll hear the song now, Down to Houston, from Dwayne Betts. You can hear this album all week long. Dwayne Betts is the artist, Isle of Hope. He is the son of Dickie Betts, founder of the Allman Brothers Band. Let us know what you think. You can text 218-326-1234. Weather tonight, we have a good chance of showers and thunderstorms, lows 45 to 49. West winds could gust up to 25. Tomorrow, Tuesday, partly...
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Lisa Bryn Rundel, sitting in for Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
a force and a reckoning. Montreal police investigate their own amid allegations of racial profiling, discrimination, and violence. A community organizer tells us people should be shocked, but she is not surprised.
Offside, an Iranian-American football fanatic says he'll be in the stadium tonight in Los Angeles as Iran plays its first FIFA World Cup match, but he won't be cheering.
Deal breaker, while Donald Trump celebrates a ceasefire, a political scientist in Jerusalem tells us why Israelis from the left, right, and center are denouncing the agreement and the prime minister.
The Great Divide. A six-year-old in Windsor, Ontario, has been visiting the site of the Gordie Howe Bridge nearly every week, almost his entire life. And now he has a message for the powers that be.
National anthem. 15 years after its release, a Bosnian band's satirical song about immigrating to the U.S. is now a soccer anthem. The band tells us why fans think the new version is pitch perfect.
And radio gaggle. A store owner in Halifax tells us she can't keep her dapper porch geese in stock, thanks to an online revival of the replica bird trend. As it happens, the Monday edition, radio that appreciates a geese offering. Montreal's police force is embroiled in controversy after allegations of coordinated, racist, and discriminatory behavior by officers in Montreal Nord. In a late-night news conference on Friday, Police Chief Fadi Daguerre announced that 16 officers from a patrol team based at Station 39 have been removed from their duties for allegedly racially profiling Black and Arab residents during street stops. Here's Police Chief Daguerre speaking to CBC's Daybreak Montreal earlier today.
To be honest with you, I don't have a clear answer now because I'm looking into the whole path before they were police officer. When they become police officer, they passed all the criteria. So what happened between when they left the academy and what happened for the last week? That's what I'm trying to find out, the whole history.
Montreal Police Chief Fadi Daguerre. Cassandra Exumé is the general coordinator of Hoodstock, a Black-led community organization in the neighborhood that has been raising concerns about systemic discrimination for years. We reached her in Montreal.
Cassandra, this is a lot for people there to process. Shock is one word that the borough mayor used to describe how she's feeling about this. What words would you use to describe it?
Shock wouldn't be one because we've been having or hearing these stories for years. I will say frustrated, really frustrated to kind of see the other side of a police brutality, to hear that they are using hair that they took from people and celebrating. That is awful and outrageous. And for me, that's how I'm feeling right now. Yeah. Not shocked, but frustrated about the full picture that we're having today.
What you're mentioning there is one of the allegations, one of the most disturbing. A source told our Radio Canada colleagues that officers were allegedly keeping people's hair, pieces of their locks in particular, as, quote, trophies. And what I hear from what you're saying there is that certainly there was this piece that people have felt marginalized and targeted and are experiencing this. But to see it laid out like this so clearly, these allegations are shaking people deeply.
You know, I'm in Montreal North right now. People are pretty much saying that was a regular Friday for us. I think it's more shocking for maybe people from the media, from the outside world, who are not living those injustices every day. but obviously it's disturbing. But sadly, it's part of their reality. And what's shocking maybe for me as a community leader mm-hmm. is, like I mentioned before, to have the full picture. It's really awful. And to kind of relieve what I lived in 2020, you know, I was in Woodstock since February 2020, and I was there just right after George Floyd and the movement and the media coverage that we had, and kind of having a hope that, okay, something's going to change. But to have the conversation again with you 6 years later, it's really discouraging, yeah.
How would you describe Montréal Nord to people who have not visited? You're not from there, but you've spent so much time working there, obviously. Very close to the community. So how would you describe it?
That's where I met my husband. He was living in Montréal Nord. When we met, he was a volunteer just like me at Woodstock. So it's really a place where I found love, I found solidarity, I found a career and a job that I really love, that I feel I have a purpose with. For me, it's a neighborhood where every neighbor knows each other. They are taking care of each other. The work that community organizations are doing is incredible. We're doing a lot with nothing. And we're always begging for more money because our population are facing so many social inequalities, but yet we're doing a lot with the least that we have. But the beauty of Montréal Nord cannot outshine also what we're hearing today. The fact that we have instances like the police who are targeting our youth and targeting people who are Black and who are from racialized community and are doing their best to kind of make them less than human. That's the reality that we're living with also.
The police chief pulled these officers from patrol duties. As we know, there's a criminal investigation underway. We'll play for you and our listeners a little bit more of what the chief told Daybreak host, our colleague Sean Henry, this morning.
To be honest with you, what we did Friday night to dismantle the whole group never happened in the history of this SPVM. So we are showing that we are very serious about our engagement, and there's going to be consequences. So there's some part of them are discouraged, and the other part is like, okay, finally, something's happening.
Does it feel to you, Cassandra, that finally something is happening, that the work you and others have done, that there's a change now?
I will say that if there's a complete end to the process, if there's a full independent investigation, well, we'll have a transparency. Because for me, that's just the first step, because what I've learned, and from my understanding, some officers can go back to maybe not be close to the community, but still keep their job. And for me, that's unacceptable. So I will talk about hope when the whole story will be completely shown, and when more stories will come out, not only from the PDQ 39, but from other, from the whole SPVM. Mm-hmm. And also when justice will be really served, because while I was walking outside, I was talking with other people who are saying, well, we're afraid to speak out. So for me, hope is a big word. Yeah. I will wait for the full process to be done, yeah.
The fact that according to our colleagues reporting, that this investigation, you know, in part is coming now because of internal reports from other police officers. The fact that the borough mayor, Christine Black, was quite emotional when she spoke about this as well. Some of that might feel different to people watching, because we don't usually hear about that kind of internal reporting or seeing politicians get emotional. Does that suggest to you that this time might be different?
I think emotions are just a start. We're looking for action, because we can cry, but if there's no action and full-on accountability and responsibility behind those emotions, for me, it's just pretty much noise. I was there during the weekend. I'm here today. People are doing their life like they would when they're to their school, and people are talking and walking and driving. For them, it's really just, like I said, their reality. For us as community leader, we're talking about the fact that the police cannot investigate on the police. We need independent investigation. We need to recognize the fact that there are social inequalities that are related to economic inequalities. And if we're not taking care of those issues, the result is that people like the police officers have more power than the community. Those are the same thing that we've been saying for almost 20 years.
Cassandra, I'm very glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
Same here. Thank you very much.
Cassandra Exumé is the general coordinator of Hoodstock, a Black-led community organization in Montréal Nord. That's where we reached her. Donald Trump is taking a victory lap, basking in praise from fellow Republicans for finally ending the war in Iran. He seemed less keen on talking about the war's toll in lives, dollars, and diplomacy. The framework agreement between the U.S. and Iran hasn't been officially released, but reportedly calls for hostilities to end and, crucially, reopening the Strait of Hormuz to shipping. For Israel, the main U.S. partner in the war, reaction has been far from positive. Benjamin Netanyahu's own supporters denounced the deal, and many on the right urged the prime minister to continue the country's military action in Lebanon. Gael Tashir is a political scientist at Hebrew University. We reached her in Jerusalem.
Gael, in a nutshell, how would you describe to our listeners how people across Israel are feeling about this deal?
This deal comes to Israelis as a colossal disaster, really, because Netanyahu promised four very precise promises coming from the conflict between Israel and Iran, and none of them was actually achieved. So Israelis see that as a disaster.
And it's notable that it's coming across the political spectrum. But let's start with on the right. Even members of Netanyahu's own coalition are upset about this. What do you make of that?
So Netanyahu just had a speech to the citizens of Israel in which he tried to portray the deal with Iran as a great success. The cleavage between the way that he presented it on camera and between how Israelis actually experience the deal, I think tells us a lot. And in a nutshell, what Netanyahu is saying tonight is that he has no idea how the agreement between the U.S. And Iran is going to look like, but he presents himself as the leader of Israel that took it away from colossal extermination by nuclear bombs from Iran. And of course, this way of presenting it says to Israelis that Netanyahu is not actually telling the truth to the Israeli people.
Some of the things, just to let our listeners know, and the speech just happened, he said that he and the U.S. president sometimes don't see eye to eye, and that even with this deal, quote, Iran will not have nuclear weapons, unquote. There were other things he said as well. But if the intended effect was to shore up his base and convince them that everything is all right, or as he intended it would be in the aftermath of this conflict, did it work?
There's a great distinction between his own media, in which he will probably come out as the great leader, and the main public media in Israel, which sees embarrassingly the lies that Netanyahu actually told in his speech today. He sees himself as the savior of Israelis from a nuclear disaster, while at the same time he's saying that he does not even know the details of the Trump deal with Iran. So this gap actually tells us that there is a problem. And the point that you raised, that Netanyahu says about himself that his relationship with Trump are great relationship, is the weakest point in his argument, because we know that Trump went publicly saying very degrading things about Netanyahu, and Netanyahu tried to basically explain this gap. But I think, you know, listening to what Trump was saying, it's clear that the relationship are at a low point.
Given that specific part of that relationship, you know, when we hear Netanyahu talking about military action in Lebanon in this latest speech, saying troops are going to remain in what Israel calls, quote, security zones there. There were new strikes on Lebanon, rockets and drones fired at Israeli forces by Hezbollah as well. So how long do you think that can continue if that is the state of the relationship between Israel and the U.S. right now, or its leaders at least?
I think Israel is at a crossroad, and I think Netanyahu has to make a decision, because it could turn a corner and go with President Trump into different set of relationship between Israel and its neighbors. Given that Netanyahu's coalition is very, very extremist, it may be the case that his political survival is going to come in the way of that and not enable a different path of peace between Israel and Lebanon. And also because Netanyahu himself is under trial and he has to remain a prime minister, it may mean that he's going to choose not the path of peace, but the path of continuous war.
How do you see this being resolved, these conflicts, ultimately?
I think that Trump has moved away from the military campaign against Iran, which could have been solved in a kind of a new Middle Eastern deal with the Gulf states and Israel, to an economic kind of campaign. And his interest is in the economy and the oil prices. So I think Trump is going to lose interest unless he can try to gain some sort of peace agreement between Israel and Lebanon. And I think, again, this might be some sort of opening gate for Netanyahu to change the route that he was leading Israel so far. And since we have elections coming up in Israel, he may try to follow this path and to try to gain some sort of normalization with the Lebanese government, which is against the Hezbollah terrorist organization. Mm-hmm. And that could show some sort of future to Israel and its neighbors.
I wanted to ask you about that fall election. What kind of a challenge is he going to be facing given the moment we're in right now?
You know, Netanyahu had a set plan for this election. He was supposed to have a very quick and resounding win over Iran with the U.S. and then have Trump endorse his election and then have an early election in which he wins. It failed miserably because the campaign with Iran actually deteriorated. Trump is now crossed with Netanyahu, and therefore Netanyahu is at his weakest political point ever in Israeli elections. But what is clear is that Netanyahu understands that he is at the weakest point, and he tries to retell the narrative of what happened between Israel and Iran as a narrative of a win. As it stands now, Netanyahu is not going to win the next election, and this is going to be the last term of Netanyahu.
Gail, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Gail Talshir is a political scientist at Hebrew University. She was in Jerusalem. On Thursday, Bosnia and Herzegovina will play its second match of the FIFA World Cup. And as the team meets Switzerland on the pitch in Los Angeles, soccer fans will hear the country's national anthem play inside the stadium. But another song has made its way into the Bosnian zeitgeist, too, becoming the unofficial anthem for the World Cup.
I'm from Bosnia, take me to America. I really want to see Statue of Liberty. I can no longer wait, take me to United States. Take me to Golden Gate, I will assimilate.
That's I Am From Bosnia, Take Me to United States by the Bosnian band Dubioza Kolektiv. The song is a remake of their 2011 hit, USA. In a matter of weeks, it's racked up almost 3 million views and can be heard in Bosnian pubs and on the streets during the World Cup. Brano Jakubovic and Vedran Mojagic are founding members of the band. We reached them in Sarajevo.
Vedran, when you and the band put out the song in its original form 15 years ago now, did you ever imagine you would be talking about it as a connection to the World Cup?
Actually, no. We had no idea and no plan. Even though some of the people accuse us that we have some prophetic things in our songs, and that we somehow, like Simpsons, managed to get the future right. So we didn't have any clue that 15 years later the song will have its second incarnation in this football context.
And Brano, how did it come to have this second incarnation? What changed?
It had nothing to do with us, basically. It was just football and football fans. During the game against Wales in Cardiff, this group of hardcore football fans from Bosnia, they just made this big banner and show it on the game. And it said, "I am from Bosnia, take me to America." They just use it as a joke for the audience and for the players, because nobody really kind of hoped that we'll be on the World Cup, because after Wales we had big Italy to win. So yeah, it was kind of, you know, semi-Bosnian dark humor joke.
So basically we recorded it with mobile phone and just put it on social networks that exact moment with the song underneath, and it went viral from there.
So it exploded.
From that moment on, we don't have any clue how it ended up in this moment.
No, actually the important thing is that Bosnia won that game, so everybody was kind of in some kind of ecstasy, and it just, they just pick up the song and this video, and it went completely mental from that moment.
Yeah, it ended up after the Italy game.
Yeah,
it ended up like with football players crushing the press conference of the manager Barbarese, singing this song, and they took him out, and they sung the song in the bus on the way to this big open air celebration. with tens of thousands of people who were also singing this song. So it basically became an anthem before, like, we knew it was happening.
An accidental anthem that started as an anthem about something else. So Vedran, back in 2011, what was your intent, the band's intent, when you first released USA?
It's like we like to play with stereotypes a lot, and this was the very stereotypical and satirical take on immigration and migration, because Bosnia is like the country of, in this moment, the one of the biggest country of immigrants, because like half of the population lives abroad, either for economic reasons or as they left as war refugees in the 90s. So it is just like very naive story of the guy from the Balkans who is having his vision of American dream, and he wants to escape the awful reality of his home country and have like beautiful life somewhere else. And during the course of the song, he realized that grass is not greener in the neighbor's courtyard, mm-hmm. and that there is no place like motherland. So he turns back and goes back home. So this was the original intent.
So then this new version of the song, obviously, it focuses heavily on football or soccer. And one goal in particular that lets us into how fans still feel. This was a 2014 goal. You scored against Nigeria. It was ruled offside. Bosnia loses that match. The fact that it's still in there in the song.
Yeah, what happened in Brazil that year.
Yeah.
And this particular non-existing offside, I have to say again, it's kind of national trauma here. So we have to put it in a song and kind of heal that wound forever.
Yeah, and
I want to come back to the original song, because I think original song is now more precise than 15 years ago, because right now there is a lot of Bosnians actually coming from states back home, because, you know, it just gets worse and worse every year for them because of the new administration there. So I think today song is more on point than 15 years ago.
How did you both feel about the match with Canada and the team's chances this World Cup?
I mean, it was big psychological pressure just watching the game, and I can imagine how the players felt on a field.
I don't know. For me, it was very important that there was no non-existing offsides. That's the only thing that I was hoping
that
for.
That was an achievement. It's true. And we watched that video. I think everyone's in agreement. Is in agreement.
But now with these referees, with the RoboCup technology, there's no way that offside gonna be non-existent.
Because if you watch the Switzerland game, you could see the same thing.
What are your hopes for the song now?
Our song is out of our hands and out of our control. Basically, doesn't belong to us anymore. This is the dream come true for every musician, that your song becomes something else and kind of, you know, people's song. So we don't even have a clue, because there is possibility that our team will go to the second round, which would be equal for us as a winning the World Cup. So if this happened, I cannot even imagine what will happen in our home country.
Brano, Vedran, a pleasure speaking with you both. Thank you.
Thank you
very much for having us.
Brano Jakubovic and Vedran Mojagic are members of the band Dubioza Collective. They were in Sarajevo.
I'm from Bosnia, take me to America. I really want to see Statue of Liberty. I can no longer wait, take me to United States. Take me to Golden Gate, I will assimilate. I'm from Bosnia, sada svugdje svira. In kraj Bosno, kao nikad do sad. A ono, protiv Nigerije nije bio offside. Mostar, Sarajevo, pa sve do Banja Luke. Kad zmajevi igraju, ajmo gore ruke. Svi u glas, nek se zna, Bosna i Hercegovina. I'm from Bosnia, take me to America.
That was I Am From Bosnia, Take Me to United States by Dubioza Collective.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, people in Windsor and Detroit have all been waiting a long time for the Gordie Howe International Bridge to open. But for one young Windsorite, that wait has lasted the better part of his entire life.
And keeping us all goosing, we speak with a retailer in Halifax who says she's hard-pressed to keep up with demand for a newly popular lawn ornament known as the porch goose. Stay tuned. I'm Lisa Brin-Rundle.
And I'm Neil Cooksall.
More coming up from As It Happens. That's the news from Canada. You hear it every weeknight at 6 o'clock here on People Powered KAXE. Later this summer, we are bringing back Ham Radio with Amy Thielen. It is our podcast about the culture of food in northern Minnesota. One of the things we'll be talking about this season will be about the Norwegian church cookbooks. Stay tuned. We'll be telling you more about it. We have talked to someone who is studying these cookbooks and what it means about the culture of the time and the religion of Norwegian Lutherans in the state of Minnesota. We receive support from Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. And thanks also goes out to Sanford Bemidji, Joe Lucan Cancer Center, providing health and healing in the local setting, sanfordhealth.org.
Tonight, for the first time in World Cup history, a qualifying country is playing a match while at war with the nation hosting the game. Iran plays New Zealand in Los Angeles, or as it's known to its huge Iranian-American community, Tarangelis. It's a complicated moment with Iran's national team representing the hopes and dreams of some football fans and the repressive regime of the Iranian Islamic Republic for others. And today, FIFA's ban on the pre-revolutionary flag of Iran was upheld in a California court, meaning the flag featuring an emblem of a lion and the sun is officially barred from the stadium. Masoud Ahmadi plays in a 60-and-over Iranian football league in Orange County, California. We reached him in Los Angeles.
Masoud, there are protests, as you know, against the Iranian team happening today. Then that same team is playing its first match of this FIFA World Cup tonight. Where do you plan to be?
Well, I'm going to be at the stadium in about 1 hour. And we're going to have a demonstration in the outside of the stadium, and along with at least minimum 3,000 to 4,000 people with 10,000 flags of lion and sun that we're taking with us.
And then what does that mean for the game? Are you going to the game?
And then we're going to the game, and we're going to take the flags with us inside of the stadium.
Why did you want to be at both?
Because we want people to hear our voice and to see our flags and let them know this is the team that is there right now is the government's team, is not a people team.
You mentioned the flag. What are your plans if you are not allowed to go inside with that flag or that emblem on even, you know, your T-shirts?
We're going to try to carry it in, and we're going to hide the flag to take it inside. And if they take it from us, we're going to grab another one. We got about 5,000 people inside. So from all over the stadium, we have people sitting at different seats so we can show the flags.
So much of the enjoyment, and I know obviously you play it, you love this sport, you love football. Will you be cheering for any of the players, the Iranian players, when you're inside that stadium?
No, I won't. I want to be the voice of people that got killed with this government, voice of the people that were in the soccer field that got killed with the government. And this is not an Iranian true soccer team that's coming here today.
What would you say to those who say these players are playing a sport they love? They may not agree with what the government is doing, but they're in this situation.
There are most of these people, they're from Sepah, which called one of the organization in the government, everybody familiar with. They went to the Sepah, and we have seen their video, we have seen their picture. If you're not with this regime and with this government, you will not play on that team.
So you're saying if the choice is between appearing to support this government or living out their own personal World Cup dreams, the decision for you is clear what they should choose?
Absolutely. To not go with this government.
As we've talked about before on our program, no diaspora is a monolith. There's a range of opinions, certainly, and it's complicated for a lot of people in the Iranian diaspora as well, not just in the United States. When you speak to other Iranian Americans, football fans in particular, what kinds of things are you hearing, the range of thoughts on this?
It's the sad story. It's a sad day for all of us. and we love to be cheering our team. But unfortunately, whoever is going there, because the people that I know that I am in contact in Los Angeles area, they're all going there because they want other people in this country or other country comes to the World Cup know that we are there to raise our voice and our concern. This is not our team.
For those who, for them personally, they can separate it. They want to go and try to enjoy the game as an Iranian-American, but they feel differently than you do. What kind of dynamic might that make for in the stands today?
Well, this is a free country, as it should be. You know, I mean, you are welcomed for your belief and go there and cheer if you like. No one gonna tell you do not cheer for them. But we are there to let FIFA know that they are not fair. FIFA is not fair. FIFA talks about gathering people together and making politics and sport different things, but that's not FIFA doing now. FIFA is actually against that. FIFA is not, you know, letting people be free and, you know, voice their opinion.
In terms of the timing, you know, as our listeners have been hearing in our other conversations on the show, this is the same day. This game is happening on the same day that, you know, we're learning more about this potential deal between the U.S. administration and Iran. Does that change things for you at all on this day? How are you feeling about that deal?
Not at all. Not at all. Because there is no deal. That you cannot trust the Iranian government. Iranian governments have never, ever came through something that you can trust on them. I know those I know people in that government. I personally was promised to go back to my country and there's nothing is going to happen to me. And I went back to the country to visit my family and they took me and I was in jail for a month just to go there, visit my family. And finally, they let me get out.
So was that the last time you went back to Iran?
Yes.
When
yes,
was that?
It was. This was 1998.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
It can be so, all of these World Cup matches for people living in diasporas can be really emotional, I know, personally, and in a good way, it can be fun. But when you're talking about this moment for you personally, you haven't been back since the late 90s, under different circumstances, I mean, this is the first World Cup match for Team Iran on American soil, but you can't be excited about it in the way that you might have under different circumstances.
Unfortunately not. And I want to take I am taking my daughter. Mm-hmm. I want her to have a World Cup experience. But unfortunately, this is not a true enjoyment for us. But we cannot not go. We wanted to go. We go there because we want to hear other people hear our voice. And my daughter is going to be part of that. I'm so thankful for that she can be with me during this hard time.
I'm glad we could speak, Masoud. Thank you for this.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Masoud Ahmadi is an Iranian-American football fan. We reached him in Los Angeles earlier today. In the eyes of the UK government, a pro-Palestine protest group is a terror organization. And today, an appeals court said it could remain that way. Earlier this year, a group called Palestine Action successfully convinced the High Court that the designation breached the right to protest. But the Court of Appeal has disagreed. On Friday, four members of the group were also sentenced after causing damage at the offices of an Israeli-based defense firm. That was the first time that convictions for criminal damage were designated as connected to terrorism. Back in February, As It Happens guest host Nora Young spoke with the UK director of Human Rights Watch, Yasmin Ahmed, after the initial High Court ruling in favor of Palestine Action. Here's part of that interview from our archives.
The terrorism law as it's drafted in the UK is extremely broad. But what also the definition of terrorism does is it means that anyone that's seen as supporting or otherwise involved in the organisation, or in fact seen as supporting the organisation, is also captured by the ban and themselves are then engaging in terrorist activity that is also unlawful. So what we had is over 2,700 people, most of whom were holding up signs that said they support Palestine action, were arrested on the streets of the United Kingdom. And I personally know a number of those individuals, and a number of them have been charged with offences, and their sentence, they could be in prison for up to 14 years for doing so. So it really highlights the inappropriate nature of using terrorism legislation for what is, for example, to respond to maybe criminal damage by a direct action protest group.
And from Human Rights Watch's perspective, can you talk a bit about what your concerns are about arresting and charging people for displaying signs?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, fundamentally, what the problem for us is that there is a fundamental right in international human rights law, and in fact, it's fundamental to any democratic society to be able to have your voice heard, to be able to protest, and to be able to assemble and speak. And essentially, what this does, what this the misappropriation of terrorism law does, is it means that people are not able to do that, and also it's a huge chilling effect on people as well. And as we have constantly been reminding this government, had this approach been taken when the suffragettes were trying to ensure that women had the right to vote, or in fact anti-apartheid activists were taking acts of civil disobedience, they, under this government, would likely have been deemed terrorists under this legislation. So it's extremely worrying from a human rights perspective. And I must say, as Human Rights Watch, we document repression in the name of counterterrorism all over the world. I mean, from Turkey to Egypt to Hungary. We did not expect that we would see this on the streets of the United Kingdom being done in the name of the British government.
From our archives, that was Human Rights Watch UK Director Yasmin Ahmed speaking to, as it happens, guest host Nora Young. A lot of people who want to see the Gordie Howe International Bridge open sometime soon, but perhaps no one more than 6-year-old Lucas Laguerre. Since he was 2, the Windsor native has been visiting the site of the bridge pretty much every week as construction was underway. His grandparents discovered a side road close to the bridge, so they would park there and let Lucas check in on the progress. And like so many others, he can't wait to actually use the bridge to get from Windsor to Detroit. CBC reporter Jennifer LaGrassa caught up with Lucas and his grandparents at the bridge on Friday on what was supposed to be opening day.
Going out on adventures, we'd pick them up on Fridays, we'd take care of them, and that we'd also always go out on an adventure somewhere. When the bridge came along, the towers were coming up, we spotted them and said, oh, let's go look at that. So it became a weekly thing. As the bridge progressed, we'd see the staging going out, and we come down and take a look at it.
Every Friday on our way in from Amherstburg, as soon as he spotted the towers, he'd say, okay, let's go to the bridge. And that was how it started. It became an every Friday thing, and then we just started documenting with pictures. So it was fun.
Lucas, why did you want to come out and see the bridge every time? What was it about the bridge?
Well, because there's a hockey player that I really like, and he's one of my favorites.
What's his name?
Gordie Howe.
What was the coolest part for you? What was the moment that you were like, wow, this is really awesome to see?
Well, there was two elevators, and I saw get them to go up and down the building, which was cool for me. We saw the crane hold the last piece together. I know how much cables there are.
Oh, tell me, how many?
216. On each side, there's 108. There are so many lights on there. But
how many lights?
I forget.
A lot.
Six thousand lights.
Today was supposed to be the day that they maybe opened the bridge, but it's not happening today. So how do you feel about that?
Sad.
Why do you feel sad?
I really want to go on the bridge.
Do you think you'll go when it does open? You'll cross over?
Yeah.
And what do you think you'll be most excited for when you do that?
Because I get to see a lot of things from down below.
How did you tell us that you wanted to cross the bridge the very first time?
By a bicycle, because by car it's a little faster, and I like to see more stuff when they're going slow. I have a new bike that's easy for me to ride it. I may want to go on it on a long trip on the bridge.
6-year-old Lucas Laguerre and his grandparents, Jeff and Sharon Marshall, speaking with the CBC's Jennifer LaGrassa. Listen, garden gnomes are great. We've covered many a gnome on this show and are demonstrably pro-gnome. So remember that when I tell you that gnomes are out when it comes to hot front-of-house decor. And porch geese are in. Geese are taking over porches across Canada and the U.S., dressed up in all kinds of outfits and proudly showcased outside their homes. And now porch geese are making a particularly strong comeback in Atlantic Canada, where the ornaments were last popular in the 1980s. Veronica Ribble is a district manager at Wheaton's, a home decor chain that sells porch geese. We reached her in Halifax.
Veronica, what do you think? Do you think this obsession, this frenzy, is going to end anytime soon?
I don't think it's going to end anytime soon. I think the more people see them out there, and the hype, our emails are still blowing up on the pre-orders. So
wow, how many on the list for pre-orders?
Well, we've gone through about 1,000. We've got we're averaging about 20 to 30 a day, and we've just pre-ordered another 1,000. So we should hopefully be able to keep up with the demand through till Christmas.
Well, let's hope. And you have some on display for sale in the store already, right? How many are there?
We do, but they, as fast as we put them out, I think we started with 40 and I'm down to 2.
For our listeners who aren't aware of this madness currently, this love of these porch geese, what do the ones you sell look like?
They really do look like a real goose from a distance. Mm-hmm. So they're metal. They're not overly shiny. They've got a lot of detail so you can see the like a feather impression on the side there. Mm-hmm. They stand about 22 inches tall, so if you actually get onto the porch, you could see his lovely little orange feet and orange beak. So,
do they have outfits? Do people customize them, buy them from you?
It's kind of all over the place. So so we haven't been able to stock as many outfits as we have geese, but again, they keep coming in. We've had a cowboy, we've had a bride and groom,
sure.
We had a cute little one that looked like a girl, like she was getting ready for bath time, like with her terry towel and headscarf and stuff like that. We've got pumpkins coming and Christmas ones, so lots. But there is a lot of online groups, and there are people that are actually making, sewing clothes for their kitty to totally personalize it. So
Giddy is the name of the geese you sell.
Yes.
Yeah. So
we carry the official Giddy. Yep.
Okay. And what do people get if they're getting a Giddy as opposed to an unofficial one?
Well, it's just that it's metal. It actually has, if I can say, an opening in the bottom. It's a plug, actually. So for a lot of people, you can fill it up with sand. So it actually holds it down on your porch so it won't fly away. There are other ones out there that are plastic. We've seen some that are ceramic. So there are different mediums. They're just different, right?
Our listeners heard in the introduction that there's a bit of history, that there's been excitement around them. before. Where did it all get started, from as far as you know?
Well, as far as I know, any kind, I've been educated myself too. So from what I understand, they were saying that it actually, geese can be quite territorial, and geese drop a lot of, if we can say, poops. So yes, for a lot of people who didn't want that, you know, on their yards and stuff like that, that's how it started. They would place a fake goose on the lawn, which right, would keep the other geese, which would keep the droppings off their lawn. So I think from there, it became, I think, just a decorative ornament, because obviously not everybody had to worry about a geese.
Sure.
So I think they just became sort of like how popular garden gnomes got.
Yeah,
at
that's
one
what
time.
I was thinking about. Sure. Yeah.
We kind of equate it to, it's like the, a little bit like everybody went through Cabbage Patch Dolls. That's
yes,
what Gibby the Geese is.
For adults, or Labubu, we talked
for
about
adults,
before, the people hanging them
but
on their purses.
Families are loving it, because a lot of parents are buying it, because like we had one customer, she's got four boys. Mm-hmm. So she's got her, you know, her Giddy the Goose, and she's only buying boy outfits. And, you know, her kids are having a blast dressing them up like a cowboy and whatever else they've got them. I think she was trying to get a Spider-Man outfit for it. Like, do you know what I mean? So it's quite cute.
Keeping up with the giddies. Why do you think mm-hmm, it's making a comeback now, and particularly in the Maritimes?
I think everybody's looking for a little ray of sunshine. And there's not one customer who doesn't pick up their giddy and is just beaming. Like, I mean, absolutely beaming with excitement. It's just adding a little bit of happiness, if that's porch happiness.
But these are not Canada geese, we should say. We know about their droppings and how territorial and tough they can
yeah,
be.
And we have sold true Canadian geese that look live, and they've always been very popular. Mm-hmm. But I think there's something about the white. It's yeah, just neutral. Giddy looks great on any porch, no matter what kind of door color or house trimming you have. The white seems to work with everything.
But yeah, you don't have a giddy yet. Is it just a matter of time, or is this a decision you've made for yourself to stand out?
I live
out?
In an apartment,
oh,
so I don't really have I guess I could put one on my balcony, but right now the staff, we're trying to stop them from buying them at the moment, just to meet
sure,
the demand through the public right now.
But you're also going to start a contest, if you haven't already, is that right?
That's correct. So for online right now, we will ask people to show us your giddy dressed up, and we're actually going to draw one winner. We'll actually win four official giddy outfits of their choosing.
Do you have any favorites right now of the outfits you've seen?
I thought the bride and groom was absolutely yeah, adorable. The boy one, he's like a black tux. He's got the little black bow tie, and she has a little white lace dress. And I just thought, for anybody that was getting married sure, or engagement parties or stuff like that, that'd be a really cute right, decor piece.
Veronica, a pleasure speaking with you. Good luck keeping up with all of it.
Thank you very much.
Veronica Ribble is a district manager at Wheaton's, a home decor chain that sells porch geese. She was in Halifax.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lisa Brin-Rundle. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Nora Young. Take care.